Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, only two topics really worth talking about this week, and we're going to talk about them. The first half of the show, we're going to take on these GDP numbers just released yesterday, get below the surface and explain really what's going on with third quarter advanced or preliminary GDP numbers just published. You know, Trump is running around saying, oh, it's a 33.1% gain in GDP. Oh, the economy is back. You know, it collapsed 32.9% in the second quarter. Oh, 33.1 must be totally back, must be totally V-shaped, right? Not. I'll explain why. In fact, all this talk about annualized statistics is nonsense, total nonsense. The U.S., I think, is the only major industrial country that uses annualized rate. What's an annualized rate? Well, basically, it's where you take the actual decline in the quarter compared to the previous quarter, and then you assume that it's going to continue for the next 9 months. That's the annualized rate. Well, nothing continues that's so dramatically changed as what we've seen this year in the economy. So it's nonsense. You know, as the Brookings Institute recently in an article described it, quote, the flashy GDP growth number for the third quarter is more a statistical quirk and reflection of the sharp dive and subsequent bounce in the spring, not an indication of current momentum. Yeah. See, because there's a base rate issue here when you talk about annualized or any statistical percentage definition of GDP. You know, if I'm starting on $21 trillion and I decline 30%, 32%, whatever, well, that's like an annual loss of $7 trillion. So the $21 trillion GDP we start with ends up $14 trillion. Of course, it didn't, but that's what it would mean. And then you have a following quarter, third quarter in this case, a recovery, but recovery not starting with $21 trillion, but $14 trillion. So that a percentage equal percentage, 33% increase off of $14 trillion doesn't give you the same absolute number than a 33% collapse off a higher number. You only get about two-thirds, three-fourths maybe, of the recovery. You see, what the total is in your base number you start with when you take a percentage change from it is important. And you can't have a comparison where you have two different bases that are so significantly changed. So this base factor is important, and annualized is nonsense. It really is. It's how you play games with statistics, you know, and percentages. The U.S. likes to play with percentages in its numbers because the percentages are misrepresentative in many cases. Let's deal with the actual numbers. The actual. Okay. So the annualized rate of GDP, let's look at this, and then we'll look at non-annualized, and then we'll look at actual numbers. In the first quarter of this year, in March alone, the economy at an annualized rate, we're still talking about that, collapsed by 5% in 1 month, in March. That's when it all began, right? COVID. 5% collapse, annualized, right? In other words, if the economy kept falling in March the way it had the rest of the year, it would be 5%, because it was only in the second half of March, you see. In the second quarter, the annualized collapse was 32.9% in the advanced GDP statistics. And then in the third quarter, it was a 33.1% increase. Okay. Again, the problem is using these annualized and different base periods to reflect all this. All right. So, you know, you gotta compare also apples to apples here. What we've seen yesterday was the third quarter advanced GDP report. You see, GDP gets reported quarterly three times. You get the early advanced, what they call preliminary advanced, which is usually changed. And then you get a second, weeks later, you get a second GDP when more data comes in. And then a couple months later, you get a tweaking of, you know, different data that maybe came in late here and there, whatever. Third report, or final report. The best report is usually the second report. But we're dealing with advanced, preliminary here in the report the other yesterday. You know, this 33.1% growth recovery. So we got to look at what were the advanced second quarter and advanced March GDP indicators, annualized still. We're still dealing with this fiction of annualized, okay? We're going to get off that fiction, but, you know, we're going to talk about apples to apples to begin with. And the apples to apples are 32.9% down and 33.1% up, advanced. Okay. Now, what you got to remember is that the actual trajectory of the last 6 months is as follows. You got a very steep contraction in March and April and the first half of May. Then you got a reopening of the economy, and you got a bounce back, you know, a rebound. And as I said before, rebound should not be confused with recovery. Okay, so we got a pretty good rebound in May, June, which didn't recover all of the collapse in March, April, but it recovered some. Okay. Now, that growth in May and June gets carried over into July, August, September. So the growth in July, August, September, third quarter, is significantly a repeat of the growth of May, June in the second quarter. Significantly. It's not really a net gain in the third quarter. It's a carryover. You know, the 33.1% in the third quarter, if we annualize, if we use the carryover in annualized terms, 23% of that would be the carryover from May, June. And that was not a net increase in the third quarter, but 23% of the 33% was carryover. Okay, let's get off of this fiction of annualized. Let's go and look at quarter to quarter. In other words, how much did the first quarter decline, and how much did the second quarter decline, quarter to quarter? How much did the second quarter decline over the first, and then how much did this last report, third quarter, rise over the second? Not annualized, just quarter to quarter, much more accurate. Still in percent terms, which are problems, but still much more accurate, quarter to quarter. The rest of the world goes quarter to quarter reports. We're the only dummies that try to obfuscate the reality by annualizing this. Okay, so let's look quarter to quarter. All right, and continue comparing apples to apples in the advanced reports, the advanced GDP reports. Okay, in the first quarter, get your pencils out. I'll go slow. Yeah, this is going to all be confusing when you're throwing a lot of numbers around. But it's important. It's important to look at the facts and the numbers sometimes, even though, you know, it may be a little work. Okay, you got your pencils? Okay. First quarter, advanced GDP collapsed 4.8%. 4.8% first quarter. Most of that late February, March. Okay. Second quarter. How much did the second quarter, in other words, April, May, June, continue to collapse off of the already collapsing first quarter? Well, another 9.5% down. Another 9.5%. So first quarter 4.8, second quarter 9.5. So the period March through June, we got a total collapse of the economy of 14.3%. That's 4.8 plus 9.5. 14.3% downturn. Massive. Massive. Worse. Worse than any of the quarters during the Great Depression of 29 to 33. Worse. Quarter collapse. You know, that whole event was kind of steady. Steady driving down every quarter, every quarter. But never more than 2.5% a quarter. You know, and here we contract 14.3% in the first, or the 4 months there, the 4 months, March through June, 14.3% advanced. Now, the final GDP numbers were a little bit lower, but we're working off of the advanced here in the third quarter, so we got to go apples to apples. Now, how much did the third quarter in the data yesterday indicate a rise in GDP in the third quarter over the second quarter? 7.4%. So we went down 14.3, and then we went up 7.4. Well, to me, that says we're only halfway recovered. If you look quarter to quarter, we're only halfway back. Well, that's not a V-shape. That's a W, the beginning of a W, as I've always predicted. You get this big collapse, the first leg of the W letter, right? And you got a half of a recovery here. Some say two-thirds, you know, half, two-thirds. In other words, the second up leg of the W letter is only half to two-thirds way back. It's not V-shaped. And as I'm going to describe here shortly, the next leg in the fourth quarter looks like it's going to be down again. We'll get back to that. Well, that means the third leg of the letter will be back down. Well, it's beginning to look like a W to me. Certainly not V-shaped unless you want to engage with the fiction, you know, of annualized rates. Now, let me add a comment to that 7.4% third quarter rise off of the second quarter collapse. It's not really net gain during the third quarter because you've got a big rebound that occurred in May-June that gets carried over into the third quarter numbers. So the 7.4 is really composed of the rebound in May-June of 5.4% and then a net 2% in July to September. Only 2% net continued gain in the third quarter plus 5.4 carried over gives you 7.4. What does that say? The momentum after the rebound in the summer has slowed dramatically. Now, I wrote about that when the first advanced numbers came out. No, the final numbers, I think. Oh, no, the initial numbers for July came out. I wrote about that. I said the rebound is slowing. the rebound of May, June is slowing here. And then we cut off the unemployment benefits here in August 1st. And a lot of people began exhausting their 6 months by August, September of unemployment benefits. And other factors began developing as well in the economy, slowing down. The momentum began dissipating in August, even in July. The momentum, very important. Because as we enter the fourth quarter, we've got some major events that are really going to depress, already are depressing, the fourth quarter numbers. But the momentum was already slowing, you see. Even the 7.4, in other words, is not 7.4 additional in the third quarter. It's only really about 2.5% additional. Very, very weak. All right. Here's a quote, by the way, from the New York Times article here yesterday by economist Ben Castleman, I think it was. And I think this is on page B1, if you want to look at it. It's pretty good for mainstream media here, right? Yeah. And he debunks correctly this idea, right, of what base you're using. You know, in other words, you got a recovery of 7.4 off of a smaller base at the end of June. Okay, to quote him, right? If you have $100 and lose half, you have $50. If you then manage to increase your money by half, that will bring your holdings back to only $75, not all the way back to $100. That's the problem of this base factor that I talked about earlier. Okay, I should have read you that quote when we started talking about that base factor, because we've moved off of it here. But if you look quarter to quarter, not annualized, things begin to look a little different, right? Yeah. The momentum of May, June was lost in the third quarter, and the momentum is disappearing even further. Now, if you look at this in just dollar terms, you get an even more accurate picture in dollar terms. In dollar terms, the first quarter dropped almost $200 billion in GDP total spending. Second quarter dropped more than $2 trillion. Even with that rebound in May, June, just imagine if you didn't have a rebound in May, June, the $2 trillion would have been $3, $4 trillion collapse. Okay, but it wasn't. And now in the third quarter, you get an increase of $1.6 trillion. So we're still down about $700 billion in GDP and almost 4%, 3.5% to 4% still down. Despite this third quarter, 7.4, which is really only 2.4 or thereabouts, right? Now compare that three, and let's take the low ball, 3.5% still down in total absolute level GDP numbers. You know, at the end of the second quarter, it was $19.4 trillion GDP. End of the third quarter, it's about a 21 plus something a rise, and we're still 3.5% down from fourth quarter. Okay, so consider this comparison. We're still $700 billion, 3.5% down after 3 months, or 6 months at most. Compare that to the Great Recession of 2007-9, 19 months, a recession of 19 months, and the total over 19 months was 4% lost GDP. Here we are, 3.5% in just 6 months. So this is still three times worse. We're still in a deep hole, in other words. Or according to the New York Times article, all 3 months that made up the third quarter were relatively weak, unquote. Now, you're not going to hear that from Trump, are you? Not going to hear that. Nope. Well, let's move on. What else can we say about these numbers? Well, let's look industry by industry. Okay? If you look industry by industry, what you got in the third quarter was a rebound in housing and autos. Residential housing, right? New housing, new construction, new sales. Because resales, refis, have no effect on GDP whatsoever. That's a resale, you know, and resales don't get of any kind. Reselling anything doesn't get counted in GDP. Because it would be double counting if they did. They counted it initially. You can't count reselling a house again, right? So resales, housing resales, you know, which are going boom, don't count. Just new construction. And there has been new construction. Feverish new construction. Well, what's driving that in the third quarter? Well, first of all, mortgage interest rates down around 3% or less, right? And a rush to the suburbs, folks that can afford it, particularly in the big cities in the East and the West Coast, right, are getting the hell out of the big cities because of COVID. And they're moving to the suburbs. And home prices in the suburbs, refi and whatever new, are booming, of course. And most of this is mid to high level income folks buying this stuff, not average, median level or below folks. Most of them are unemployed. But, you know, residential housing for GDP terms has gone up. It's about 5% more than it was at the end of last year. So there is an increase there, and that's what's driving some of that net 2% or 5% in May, June. 7.4%, right? Some of that is housing. Another big element of that is autos. Auto sales are up, you know. Auto companies were in deep doo-doo in the second quarter. Big inventory buildup. No one was buying anything. No one was going out looking. So now they're almost giving them away. I mean, it's pretty easy to get a zero interest loan here, nothing down, you know, on a new Toyota, for example. Right? They're selling off their bloated inventory. They get some good deals on new cars. Right? And, of course, people who can afford it, who still have jobs, you know, are buying. So autos are up. Housing is up. If housing sales are up, then, you know, you get some other effects there. Furniture, people buy furniture and stuff like that. And housing, you would probably have to include the cost of renovating, you know, upgrading, people spending money on their homes that they have. Now, that gets into GDP. If you upgrade your house, you know, you build an addition to it or something like that, that gets in GDP. That's occurring. So housing and autos, you know, driven by low interest rates and some of these other factors, are behind the recovery. So is manufacturing of goods, or what we call durables, durable goods, things that last more than a year. That's up. In fact, it's up nicely, 11% over fourth quarter of 2019. Yeah, people are buying things because they're not spending as much money on services. You see, they're not out spending money. Services are down almost 8% over fourth quarter of 2019. By the way, commercial property, commercial construction is way down, 15% almost. You know, what is that? Oh, that's building office buildings and hotels, you know, and resorts, and theme parks, you know, stadiums and stuff like that. That's down because those are services, you see. That's in a very, very depressed state. Right. So services, Commercial construction are down. Transportation's down 23%. Even healthcare is down in the third quarter, 7%. Well, you would think, gosh, you know, aren't people spending more? No, because they're afraid to go to hospitals, and the hospitals are tied up with COVID cases, so they're putting off a lot of what otherwise people would be going to the hospitals and their doctors for. And, of course, we had a shutdown there, doctor's office, dentist's office for a while. So, you know, healthcare is still down. Non-durables like food, well, people are buying more food because they're not going to restaurants. So we do have some areas, consumption, that are up. Autos, housing, you know, food, etc. Consumption, by the way, is almost 70% of the economy, about 68%. You know, and retail is about a fourth of that, retail sales. Buying online is up, of course, just as buying from brick-and-mortar places is down. Okay. Now, why do we have consumption still occurring in the third quarter, some of it? And where is that going? Well, because the CARES Act back in March really did provide over $1 trillion in people's pockets to spend. But it's dissipating. It's wearing out. It's almost gone. That stimulus is almost gone. You know, when they ended the supplemental $600 unemployment benefits, when they ended that at the end of July, right? That cut unemployment benefits by 42%. Total benefits, payments, 42%. They restored it a little bit with Trump's phony $300, but that's gone now too, right? So you still have some consumption going on because of that CARES Act passed in March. It really boosted savings, you see. Normally, the savings rate, household, median household savings rate, is about 6% of your income. Well, with the extra unemployment and the checks and the money going to grants going to small businesses and the PPP program and so forth, right? The savings rate in April went up to 33%, from 6% to 33%. People had a lot of money in their pockets. And, you know, immediately they couldn't spend it anywhere until the economy began opening in late May, June, and they started, and they continued to spend, you know, on houses, on cars, and so forth, into the third quarter. Okay, but that's dissipated. Now, the savings rate, as of late August, is down to 14%, and it's going lower. That's a sign that, you know, the stimulus is wearing out what we had. Now, spending consumption is not just based on savings, in this case, but also on what's called a wealth effect. In other words, the wealthier your assets are, the more you feel like spending. Well, you know, the stock market's been booming, hasn't it? So the 10% of the population that owns stock, most of that really the top 5 and then the top 1%, but that wealth effect, as they call it, does stimulate some consumption. And of course, the wealth effect's been very positive, hasn't it, with the stock market booming. You've probably heard all those statistics about billionaires making so much more money out of the stock market in the last 6 months. It's a strange depression, you know? It's a strange one where you've, for the first time, you've got those at the top really making money, really making out, and those at the bottom really bad off. You know, in the Great Depression of the 1930s, everyone kind of collapsed. You know, in this 1929 to 33, you know how much the stock market collapsed in value? 89%. It went down 89% in that depression. In this depression, what do we got? It's up. Strange, it's up. What about wage incomes? Well, wage incomes are down even worse today than they were in 1929 to 33. So it's a very strange, lopsided, weird depression that we are in. Never had anything quite like this before. Which means it's got to be hard to predict where it's going. Okay, so the wealth effect did contribute to consumption, particularly people buying homes, right, out in the suburbs, those who could afford it. But as far as jobs and wage income, that's pretty much fallen off a cliff. Well, how many do we have unemployed? I estimate somewhere between 30 and 33 million still unemployed. Quite different than that statistic you hear in the media, you know, what, 9% unemployed, maybe 12, 13 million. No. In fact, 23 million people are still getting benefits, even though people are falling off the unemployment benefit rolls at a rate of a million a week. Still, we have 23 million getting benefits. And yesterday as well, we had again a million, 1.1 million new claims for unemployment benefits, counting the federal and the state program together. We've had 32 plus weeks of more than 1 million people filing for first-time unemployment benefits. 32 weeks, ever since mid-March. We started out with like 6-7 million for the first couple of weeks claiming benefits, but we're still a million every week. You know, a million in and a million dropping out the other end. Now, that doesn't make for continued consumption. Now, those folks' consumption patterns were propped up by the CARES Act, the unemployment benefits, which are gone, the checks, which are gone, and the fact that they didn't have to pay rent or, in some cases, mortgages because of the forbearances, which were part of the CARES Act. Forbearances meaning you suspend your payment. So they had that extra money. So the unemployment benefits, the extra money from forbearances, the checks, all that kept consumption going. And in May, June, it was released. And it's continued into the third quarter, but it's drifting off. It's drifting off. I estimate there's at least 10 million people who are unemployed without benefits. So we're well over 30 million. Is that a V-shaped recovery? 30 plus million people without jobs still? No. That alone pretty much negates that argument, right? And wage income is really for those who are working off. Why? Because those who got the jobs back came back, often came back with less hours worked and therefore less weekly income. And we got more long-term unemployed now growing. And we have announcements of mass layoffs by companies, even those that did not shut down, you know, tech companies and other mainstream companies. So the wealth effect will continue unless the stock market takes a dive and it's getting shaky. Wage income and hours of work, no. Jobs, no. Savings going down. And no stimulus to keep the thing going. So that's the industry by industry look, I think. What about the fourth quarter, right? Well, as Dean Baker, you know, a pretty good economist, has said, we are likely to see negative growth in the fourth quarter. Or as the Brookings Institute, Shambaugh, I think his name is, right, said, the economy is still slowing down. Third quarter momentum is weakening. And I've been arguing that the fourth quarter is going to run into a wall made up of three things. One, no stimulus. We're not seeing a stimulus here this year. Second, the COVID Third wave is here, worse than ever before. It will result in some partial shutdowns, but it will also dampen demand. People just aren't going to go on airplanes when you have this much of a problem. You know, they're not going to go on to hotels. They're not going to go into restaurants. They're not going to go into, inside sports and entertainment events, whether or not they shut down. And then political instability, which we'll talk about here shortly, which can be very severe starting next week, and which will dampen people's consumption and business investment. That's the wall that the economy is running into that Baker mentioned, right? Slowing momentum third quarter, really not 7.4, really about 2% net. And now momentum of that slowing down. And I predict even the housing and autos and durables will slow. Why? Because interest rates can't go lower. They're pretty damn low where they are. The Fed isn't going to lower rates. If it does, it goes negative. It's not going to do that. It said it won't. So the rate, the stimulus for new housing and from autos, from interest rate declines, is going to have less effect, right? Pent-up demand from the second quarter that we've seen here, that's going to be exhausted. Job and wage incomes are not growing. We got only high-end buyers leaving the big cities, mostly. And in autos, same thing. Savings are running down. Pent-up demand being exhausted in for autos. Rates can't go lower. Can't go lower than zero, right? Zero interest rate to buy a car. Can't go lower than that. Well, I guess they can start giving you more money back to pay the sales tax, which will be going up, right? So you can't count on consumption, which was responsible for 3/4 of what happened in the third quarter here, even as it dissipated. You can't count on that in the fourth quarter, right? We don't have any more unemployment, supplement on unemployment. Hours are less. Wage incomes are down. More COVID. Both shutdowns and general demand. The forbearances on rents are already ending. Where are people going to come up to pay that back rent? If they pay some of it, you think they're going to spend it somewhere else? No. That's no net stimulus to the economy. Even mortgages. The forbearance on the mortgages, many people have. They won't come to an end until early next year. State and local government taxes and fees are going to rise because there's no bailout of the states and local governments in the stimulus that isn't happening. Credit cards. People have been using them to pay down debt. Net exports as a contribution to GDP fourth quarter doesn't look good, because global trade is going to slow down again with this massive surge in Europe, and who knows where next. Going to dampen trade and exports. Business spending. Well, commercial property business spending, don't expect anything there. Inventories. They've already rebuilt their inventories off of the second quarter. They're not going to build them any further. State and local government. Spending is anticipated to decline and taxes to rise. Well, that's the real picture, folks, the real picture of this just released advanced U.S. GDP for third quarter numbers. The takeaway is that a lot of the third quarter was momentum from the second, May, June carried over. The net increase in the third quarter was tepid and minimal. That momentum is continuing to slow down. We don't have the unemployment benefits. There is no stimulus forthcoming. Boy, they really needed to pass the stimulus there in August, September at the latest, but they lost that whole thing because of politics. Trump never really wanted it. McConnell never really wanted it. They were all playing games. trying to suck Pelosi and Schumer into lowering once again their offer and then walking away from it. Yeah, pretty clear now that that was there. It was all tactical. You know, they never had any intent because their rich folks are doing all right. They don't need it. No, they don't need it. It's the people, the working class and small businesses that desperately need it. We really see a split in the capitalist economy now, you know, and where all the wealth is going. It was going that way before, but now it's so dramatic, you can see it. Income inequality is accelerating at a faster, even faster rate than ever before. It doesn't look good. Not only is the 33%, you know, a big hype, it's not V-shaped. Very clearly, my prediction of W-shape is coming through. You know, they sometimes talk about K-shape, right? The K-shape represents the fact that the wealthy and part of the economy is booming, the up, you know, up leg of the K, and then you got a down leg of the K letter, and that's the service economy and workers and the unemployed and the small businesses going under and so forth, right? K-shape. Well, the K-shape is just the short-term indication that we're in the process of experiencing a longer-term W-shape. The K-shape is the second short leg here of the W. Okay. Now, a minute ago, I said that, you know, the big mitigating factors to growth and, you know, if Baker is right, we'll have a negative downturn. You know, Baker's pretty, Dean Baker's pretty conservative and careful about what he says. I was surprised to hear him say that, quote, we are likely to see a negative growth in the fourth quarter, not just the slowdown of GDP, but a negative. I mean, a clear double dip, right? We'll see. He may be right because we have some big forces moving against the economy, as I've said. COVID resurgence, no stimulus, political instability. Let's talk about that latter point, political instability. Take a look at my blog. I published two articles this past week on my blog, you know. The first one at the beginning of the week that really addressed the Amy Barrett confirmation. Right? Go to my blog, jackrasmus.com. And two articles there, the two most recent articles. One is Barrett confirmed by the U.S. Senate, post-election political instability now inevitable. You can also go to Counterpoints and ZNet and get it there. Global Research, wherever. And then the second article, just published a day or so ago, is Why the Record Vote Turnout May Not Matter. What do I mean by that? Well, if you listen to the media, CNN and all the others, what do you got? You got this big focus going on oh, this massive voter turnout that we've got, right? Big voter turnout. Record turnout. Well, it's not clear who's really turning out the turnout. You know, it may be both sides. Because Trump is running a better campaign, I think. You know, he's out there. Yeah, he's having these mass meetings and everything. But it's stimulating his people and his turnout, even though, you know, a lot of them are going to get COVID. But he don't care about that. You know, and what do we got with Biden? You know, the cameras are on him. But once in a while, they show the audience there. And what do you got? You got maybe a couple dozen people sitting in circles on the grass. You know, I don't think Joe can really get out there and hustle. And I really found it strange that Obama is out there in front of people in Florida speaking on Biden's behalf. He's holding mass rallies. Yeah. But Biden's not. Be worried, folks. Be worried. Because in the second article, Why the Record Vote Turnout May Not Matter, I look at the electoral college, because that's what it's all about, you know? All this media talk about, Biden's ahead by 11 points in the popular vote is totally irrelevant because the popular vote has nothing to do with the selection of the president. The electoral college has everything to do with it. You know, that archaic institution put into the U.S. Constitution to check the popular uprising of the people and the will of the people. That's why it was in there. That's why it was put in there. You know, in the Constitution 1789, Electoral College, you know, let the states select the president. Yeah. Oh, and it was that way for the senators, too. And all women couldn't vote, and slaves couldn't vote. And we had to have some pretty big popular uprisings and fights in order to get rid of that, to direct elect the senators. We had to have amendment. You know, the same thing, we had an amendment to allow women to vote. And we had to have a civil war before we could allow black folks to vote. But we still have this electoral college, you see. That's the dampening effect for popular, direct democracy, voting for your president. And if you look at the electoral college, as I did this past week, and the likely states, and how many electoral votes they have, and where they lie in terms of supporting Trump or Biden, my estimation is that it's virtually tied going into the next Tuesday. My estimation is that in Trump's camp, 248 electoral votes, fairly secure. Biden's camp, 244, virtually secure. Now, there's only 538 electoral votes, you know? So we got maybe 40, 45 votes, electoral, that are swinging. And you know where they are? They're in the Midwest. Yeah. They're Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. Those three states. Which are the states Hillary didn't even bother going to and why she got trumped? That's a pun. Yeah. Those are the true swing states. Those are the two swing states, you see. So what matters is the popular vote in those few states, because everything else is pretty much lined up. And I don't believe the CNN and what they're talking about, you know, the big margins in Arizona and the big margins, you know, some margins in North Carolina and Ohio. No, I don't believe that. This is a very close election in the Electoral College. And that is why the closeness of the election is why Trump's strategy to win is to stop the mail-in ballot vote count in those swing states. Now, those three states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, are states that don't even start counting the mail-in ballots until midnight on November 3rd. They're not counted yet, you see. In some states, they start counting them early, so they come in, but not in those states. Yeah, Pennsylvania may have just changed with a court decision. I'm not sure. So Trump already has hundreds of lawyers on the ground out in those states and a few others where they are filing legal actions already, and on November 3rd will file even more to stop the mail-in ballot vote count. And why is that important? Because 55% of Trump supporters, according to a CNN poll a couple of weeks ago, will show up to vote on November 3rd, whereas only 21% of Biden supporters will show up to vote. They're voting by mail ballot. That's why he wants to stop that vote. I've been predicting in articles on the blog, read them, you know, that Trump is going to declare victory on November 3rd or early on the 4th. He's going to declare victory based upon the votes that are counted by those who show up to vote, which will show him probably winning, at least in those swing states, because the other states don't matter. You know, maybe some states like Arizona, Nevada might be close. You know, I don't know if there's swing state. There might be a swing state because it's so close, you see. But what do we got? Pennsylvania, 20 votes. Michigan, 16, I think. And Wisconsin, 10. Minnesota, 10. You know, Arizona, only 5 or 6. Or maybe Nevada, 6. You know, Iowa, 4 or 5, I forget. Those are the states that are going to matter here. It may be so close that these two maverick states where you can split your vote for the candidate might determine the outcome. Nebraska does that by district. In other words, you could have some of their 5 votes going to Trump, some of them going to Biden, and the same with Maine does the same thing. Those two states are the only ones that split. Well, you know, I can pick up 1 or 2 vote there, you know. If that's how close it is. Forget what CNN says. Totally irrelevant. Okay, so continuing here. I predict what's going to happen. He's going to declare victory, and he's going to try to stop the vote. And remember, McConnell has put a lot of federal judges in appeals courts in a lot of places. I think they know who to file these charges with, right? These injunctions to stop the vote. They know. Trump knows. His lawyers know. You know, because these Republican lawyers have done it before. They did it with George W. Bush in 2000. The Supreme Court stopped the vote in Florida and gave, de facto, gave Bush the presidency. There's a precedent in doing this. And you want to know who were some of the lawyers who worked for Bush to get that job done? You want to know? Amy Coney Barrett. Kavanaugh, and I think Roberts, too. I'm not sure. But I know those two turkeys were on Trump's team, legal team. You think now they're on the Supreme Court, they won't vote the same way? You betcha. Trump's plan is to rush it through his federal appeals court, McConnell-appointed judges, the injunctions, and get them up to that Supreme Court with a 6-3 majority and get the Supreme Court to endorse it. That's his plan. Now that, my friends, is a legal coup d'etat. And that's what we're facing next week, I think. Worst case scenario. You know, I hope I am wrong. If I ever was wrong, I hope I'm wrong. But boy, in a gut, I just don't feel I am. I think that's what's coming. That's what's coming next week. And if it does, then people are going to rush out into the streets. And that's just what Trump wants, because he's going to call his Proud Boys and others to come out in the streets, too. You know, take on these Antifa and BLM guys, right? He's going to say, bring your guns. Yeah, we'll have chaos in the streets, possibly. And, you know, Trump likes that idea, too, because then he can go to the Supreme Court and say, hey, you know, chaos. Come on, you gotta dampen this down, Supreme Court, here, or we're gonna, you know, fall apart in this country. You know, and you know, the Supreme Court will listen to that argument. Yeah. Well, if we can dampen it, you know, let's put it to an end here. It's all quite possible. And if it is, you can imagine the economic impact of that, both in business spending and in consumer spending. On top of no stimulus, on top of the worst COVID wave coming. Dean Baker may be right. It may turn negative fourth quarter with the momentum lost already and no stimulus. So forget this hyping of popular vote and big early turnout. What matters is not the turnout, but the counting of the turnout. That's the issue. And why is CNN, MSNBC, and all the others, you know, not talking more about all these efforts that are underway by Trump lawyers to pull this off? All we get is, oh, big turnoff. Vote, vote, vote early. Go vote. Vote now. Will they get counted is the question. And, you know, the battleground states are not, you know, CNN talks about battleground states. Oh, Texas, or maybe Georgia, maybe Florida, Ohio, North Carolina. Not. These are not battleground states. These are voter suppression states. And there's no reason to believe that the voter suppression is any different than it is now. No reason to believe. No evidence. In fact, you got a lot of empirical evidence that the suppression is even more intense than it's ever been. No, those aren't battleground states. Those aren't yellow states. Those are Trump states. And it's going to remain that way, I think. So you got this Trump strategy, and you got the Electoral College, and you got the Supreme Court in his pocket, and that's a bad combination. In my last article, I talk about the Electoral College and what can be done about it. And I talk about the Supreme Court and what should be done about it. You know, this Supreme Court, you know, as I've said before, go to the U.S. Constitution. You know, all it says is that Congress will create a court system with inferior courts and one at the top, quote, quote, superior. In other words, it's just a reference to a hierarchy of courts. It says nothing about the Supreme Court being superior over the legislature, Congress, or the executive. That's not in the Constitution. But it's become that, hasn't it? It's become that. And what has the Supreme Court done? You know, gave the presidency to George Bush in 2000, right? Passed Citizens United, made the rich folks have an inordinate influence over elections. 2013 pretty much undermined the 1965 Voting Rights Act, allowed all this voter suppression to continue, and even now it's going on. And now they got a 6-3 majority for business and radical right interests. An institution that is not a co-equal to the legislature and the executive under the U.S. Constitution, but it usurped that power in 1803. Now, we need to change that Supreme Court and not just shorten and eliminate lifetime appointments. We need to radically restructure that Supreme Court, and I talk about how to do that in this last article. We need to make it elective, not appointive. And the Electoral College, you know, we don't need a constitutional amendment to change the Electoral College. All we have to do is, under the Constitution, increase the number of representatives, which would increase the number of electors in favor of the blue states instead of this red state majority, small state majority, dominating Electoral College. We can do that. You know the last time Congress did that? 1913. All it has to do is increase the number of representatives to reflect the population, which the Constitution says must be done. Hasn't done it for a century. And you could eliminate that small state bias in the Electoral College and then amend it to get rid of it. These are things that can be done and should be done immediately after the election, if Trump doesn't win. Okay. Democracy is in decline in America, and that decline is accelerating. And Trump is about to pull off a coup. And what will the Democrats do? We will see next week. Okay, that's it. I'm out of here.